Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of August 1st, 2014. At the end of the week, it's often time to sit back and assess what you spent, what you owe. You tally it up and get an economic snapshot of who you are, as a person or a family or even a country. And that's what we're doing this week. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend. This episode of our show is about debts and costs, what we spend and how we prioritize on our children or our food or even some stuff that makes you say, man, that is everywhere and it's too much. I can't take it anymore. Our show is always informed by what you tell us. So come join the conversation at marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. But first, here's your economic week in 20 seconds.
209,000 jobs added last month below expectations. The unemployment rate ticks up.
Bank of America was ordered to pay $1.27 billion to settle a civil case over the Hustle program.
According to a new report, more than a third of all Americans with credit files had some kind of debt in collection last year.
We want to get straight to Buenos Aires right now because Standard & Poor's says that Argentina defaulted on its debt for the second time in 13 years.
And that last clip you heard is our top story of the week. It's about what we spend and owe, and owe, and owe, and owe in this case. Talks broke down between Argentina and some of its bondholders, triggering that default. And to dig a little deeper, we brought in Tim Fernholz. He's a reporter at Quartz. Thanks for joining us.
It's lovely to be here.
All right, Tim, I have a challenge for you. I want you to explain how Argentina got into this mess, but you are not allowed to use any analogies involving Leo Messi, the World Cup, or Evita. Go.
All right. Argentina, a long time ago, in the late 90s, borrowed a ton of money from everyone around the world in New York City. And then its economy got in trouble. A lot of social unrest, high unemployment. They had five presidents in 2 weeks, which is a lot of presidents, and basically said, look, it's going to be easier for us if we just don't pay back any of these debts that we have. And they defaulted, and this was in 2001. It was the biggest default in history. Since then, they've sort of come around, and they basically told all the people they borrowed money from, listen, we're going to pay you back, but we're only going to pay back about 50 or 60% of what we borrowed. And most of the people who borrowed that money said, all right, sure, we'll take that deal. But a small minority of those lenders said, no, we want all of our money back. And they spent the next 13 years fighting them in court, trying to seize their naval vessels abroad, and ultimately got a U.S. court to say, listen, you can't pay any of your debt until you pay these guys who held out. And these guys who held out are called vulture funds in Argentina. And they don't like being called that, but that's what they're called.
But they do play a purpose in terms of how money moves around the world. Tell us what they do.
So the vulture funds wait for somebody to get in trouble, just like a vulture might in the desert looking at someone running out of water. When a country gets in trouble and all of the people who loan them money are really desperate to get rid of those bonds and say, you know, just get out of this, the vulture funds will come along and say, hey, I'll give you 20 cents on the dollar for that. Buy it really cheap, because they think they can wait around long enough or sue long enough or negotiate long enough to get that money back. But that's important because it allows for distressed debt, these sort of sovereign bankruptcies, to actually get resolved, and the people who bought that debt and were stuck with it to have a way out. It sort of makes things more commercial.
If Argentina has to suddenly pay everybody, that would pretty much wipe out what we think of as their bank account, their foreign exchange reserves, the money they have on hand, right?
Pretty much. That's certainly what they say in Argentina, and is one reason they don't want to pay. Arguably, they could have paid the vulture funds right last month and still had a good chunk of money left over. They would have probably paid about half of their bank account, so to speak. But now that they're in default, there's a lot more questions and they might owe a whole lot more money. If you ask Argentina, what they'll say is if they pay these vulture funds, they also have to give the same deal to all the other people they borrowed money from before and said they were going to stiff. And if you ask them, they say that's going to cost them $500 billion, which is a crazy huge amount of money and way more money than they have on hand.
Default sounds like such a scary word. And anybody who hasn't paid a bill and has had a debt collector call them certainly knows the fear that it strikes in you. Is this the end of the world, though, in terms of how it might ripple through the broader economy?
The short answer is no, it's not. Because Argentina has been such sort of a troublemaker in the financial world for so long, the problem for the globe and the rest of us who are not in Argentina or owning their debt is that every now and again, countries do default, and sometimes for good reason. We saw it happen in Europe in the last couple of years with Greece and other countries there just sort of on the edge of default. And people like the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, are really worried that in the future, if a country does have to restructure its debt, it's going to be really hard now because of the precedent created by this New York ruling and the Argentina experience. Basically, no country is ever going to be able to shed its debt in the future, which could be a real problem.
Tim Fernholz from Quartz, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. We wanted to talk about some of the other economic issues out there. Plus, it's the weekend, so let's have brunch. All right, we are out having brunch at the Cornerstone Tavern on 2nd Avenue in New York. And today I have Kevin Roos from New York Magazine and Shannon Bond from the Financial Times. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Hi.
It is nice to have you. I want to start, though, with a week where I feel like I'm not sure what money is anymore. Snapchat is worth $10 billion, maybe? How is that possible? That blows my mind.
They want to be worth $10 billion, and I think they very likely probably will get that funding at that level.
That's because bananas.
It is bananas. They have no revenue to speak of. But you know what they do have is attention. And if you remember back when Facebook and Twitter were young, people said, well, they'll never make any money. They're just doing this crazy growth where they're amassing users without turning them into dollars and cents. And then, of course, they got so big that when they did finally start selling advertisements, they had, you know, millions, hundreds of millions of users.
Right. You hook everyone in, and then that's it.
And then you've got them.
You live in San Francisco, we should point out.
Yes.
You're in the belly of the beast.
Right. I'm in Silicon Valley proper. And I see teenagers who use Snapchat as their primary mode of communication. And that's what makes me think that someday this could actually be a justified level of valuation.
Shannon, you cover media. Does this seem nuts to you?
I mean, it does seem nuts on the one level. On the other hand, if you're Snapchat, you're feeling pretty good about not having taken that, $3 billion from Facebook. So these people, they're not necessarily buying a lot of things now, but they will be. And you've got their attention. And if you are the place they're going to be, these teenagers, they're not on Facebook.
No, I guess Facebook is for moms and the people
right?
I went to high
school
with.
It's for their parents.
Right,
it's for their parents, which is terrifying.
We're old. But, Twitter's not really making money. Now, they're growing users. We saw their numbers come out, but the cash?
Yeah, there's a lot of questions, right, around and how valuable a Twitter user is at this point. There's a lot of people on Twitter. Are they really on Twitter? They don't use it. And some of the acquisitions they've been making in terms of advertising are actually about advertising not even on Twitter. So it's a little unclear. But Facebook's made the jump into...
Facebook's a juggernaut now.
Yeah.
They've really cannibalized the sort of advertising market. I mean, I never thought that would work. I mean, I don't click on... Whenever I click on a Facebook ad, it's by accident, right?
Exactly. the fat thumb syndrome.
Right, exactly. But someone out there is clicking these things,
absolutely,
clearly, because they're making money hand over fist.
Yeah, and everyone in the ad world is trying to figure out, how do we do it? How do we make sure that the people on Twitter, Snapchat in the future, Instagram...
Do you use Snapchat?
I don't. I'm way too old for Snapchat. Are you kidding?
Do you use it?
I use it, yeah.
What do you do with it?
I don't feel comfortable. No, it's all very PG.
Weird stories of the week. Martha Stewart has a drone.
This is my favorite story of the week. Martha Stewart wrote an essay for Time about how much she loves her drone. She has one of those sort of flying helicopters and she uses it. She said, you know, I use it to take pictures of my farm. I use it
those
to...
Those pictures were great.
Oh, they were awesome.
They were really cool.
And then I loved her line. She said, imagine what they would have been able to do with a drone at Versailles.
But if you're Martha Stewart, that's clearly your
that's
go-to.
That's a metaphor right there.
right.
I mean, it almost inspired me. I have to say, I'm feeling very tempted right now to buy a drone.
Kevin,
you can control it with your watch.
I would be a total stereotype, but I really want one.
Do you have a favorite weird story of the week?
My favorite story of the week is Tinder going to start making money finally for owner IAC? So Tinder is the super popular iPhone dating app, right? It's super exciting. You get to look through pictures of people from your who are connected to you on Facebook.
And you swipe
right to say you like them. And
okay.
You swipe left to throw them away. And there's something really satisfying. It's you know,
swipe,
when people talk
swipe,
about
swipe.
Gamification, which is one of those jargon words in Silicon Valley, but this is fun, gamification. And they're owned by IAC, the big internet conglomerate owned by Barry Diller. And they've been trucking along. They've been adding users. They've seen quite a lot of growth, even despite the fact that IAC and Tinder are being sued by one of the former executives of the company for sexual harassment and discrimination.
And they're sued by a female former executive, and yet we have not seen so far, right, any backlash among female users, correct?
Really doesn't seem so. They don't break down their user growth by demographics.
Okay.
But they've seen really strong growth. I think it's 140% user growth since the beginning of the year. It was particularly strong even in June, the last month of the quarter they just reported. And now they're saying they're going to start to monetize by the end of the year. So basically they're going to maybe do a combination of some advertising, some things where the app will be free, but you could pay perhaps to contact somebody.
Right, they're really hot users. You have to pay to swipe right on them.
Exactly.
Wait a minute. Like, really?
No, I don't think some of the basic functions, but they've done this effectively with OkCupid. They have actually managed to monetize. There's some additional features you can
pay for. Is that also owned by IAC?
It's also owned by IAC. They also own Match.com. They have cornered the dating market.
I heard a story that's sort of related to this, which I loved, which was that there's now an Uber for divorce. There's a startup that is trying to use technology to make it radically easier to get divorced. So I think Tinder should acquire them so that they can have the whole spectrum.
Exactly,
you know, meet the
lifetime
person,
value of
marry
the user.
Them, and then divorce them all within Tinder.
Shannon Bond from the Financial Times, Kevin Roos from New York Magazine. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, workers are walking off the job and taking to the streets to support a millionaire CEO?
The media says that they've never seen anything like this before. Well, I got news. Welcome to Market Basket!
That and a look at mobile messaging. That's next on Marketplace Weekend from APM. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
This is tech in real life.
So I've got my phone in my hand. We don't know where Ben went. It's either a video or a picture that says where he... Oh, I got one. Okay.
Okay, Lizzie, here's your first piece of evidence right here. I'm sending you a video of this place that I'm in right now. Can you tell where I am?
I think I know where you are, and I think we're going to try and come find you. I see them. They are right past a hot dog truck, which actually smells pretty good. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
Ben Johnson, you are the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Why were we just chasing each other on the block and playing hide and seek?
We're doing it because messaging apps are officially a thing. They're huge. In terms of how much they were being used, messaging apps grew over 200% in 2013. Facebook actually bought WhatsApp for $19 billion earlier this year, as I'm sure you know. There's talk of the disappearing message app Snapchat being valued at $10 billion. It's a big deal.
Why do we see carriers and other companies attaching such big valuations to them?
Okay, well, even in our super tech-savvy world, communication is still a thing we love to do, even if we do it poorly, right? And WhatsApp, for instance, has calculated that its average user spends multiple hours of time every week in the app. So just think of all
that's messaging within the app.
Yeah, within the app. They're actually spending that time looking at the app. Advertisers want a piece of that real estate. If you're spending a lot of your information superhighway time on the Snapchat or WhatsApp superhighway, advertisers want that billboard space. So companies want to be in front of our eyeballs, and since our eyeballs more and more are fixed on our devices and on the messaging apps on those devices, the best way to be in front of our eyes is to be part of the messaging apps we're using.
Let's break some of this down, because some of these messaging apps are binary almost to the point of seeming banal, right? There's the app Yo, which literally just sends yo's back and forth. Yo.
I still got Yo on my phone.
Yeah, I deleted that.
Yeah, you deleted it.
Why these apps? Why not send a text message? I know the answer. I want you to spell it out, because I think it's really interesting. This is about money.
Yeah, it is. Between March of 2013 and March of 2014, just as an example, messaging apps added 900 million people. So that's not just people like you and me. That's people all over the world. So a big part of this is because they're frictionless. They're really, really simple to use. Even though you and I may be trading a really stupid message or a simple message, the user experience is really nice. There's another part of that, and that is that you and I don't know what your messaging, your plan is like for your phone, but I only get 1,000 text messages a month. And admittedly, I'm not a teenager, so I don't send that many, but I do get charged for going over those text messages. What people are using these apps for is they're figuring out a way to very simply and cheaply send each other information.
So this is an end run around an SMS fee or whatever your cap of messages is.
Yes, it is. Now, obviously, messaging apps do use data, so you do get charged for your data, but depending on your plan, maybe you can use data instead of SMS, vice versa. And it's really kind of actually changing the way some of these bigger companies do business.
Do we know yet how the big companies are adapting to this change? I would imagine they're looking at this and going, uh-oh, this might threaten my business model.
Well, I think they are. I mean, we don't know yet exactly how this kind of change in user behavior is impacting the company's bottom line, right? But we do see this change in behavior from the companies themselves. I'll give you an example. Just this week, Virgin Mobile started offering this new kind of custom mobile data plan. It's friendly to people who just really want to do only one kind of thing on their phones. You can pay $12 a month, and you can choose between just using Facebook unlimited data or just using Instagram unlimited data or Twitter or Pinterest. So this is kind of a proof that these companies are thinking about ways to let their users customize the way that they communicate and trying to actually figure out a way to charge them more money for certain things so that they can still make money as wireless companies.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Lizzie.
I talked about what we spend and owe at the top of the show. A lot of us spend our money at the grocery store over the weekend. That's a little tough right now if you shop at a Market Basket grocery store in New England. There are 71 of them, and almost every one had protests this week. Protests in support of, get this, the millionaire former CEO. The company's board pushed him out in a massive family feud, and now the chain is losing millions of dollars as thousands of employees and customers have hit the streets. We asked WGBH reporter Rupa Shenoy to get to the bottom of this story.
For the past few years, there's been a ton of talk about economic inequality and an angry 99%. So the idea that regular people would take to the streets to support a corporate CEO might seem as strange as dogs and cats living together or Democrats and Republicans having a picnic to politely discuss policy. But people like Market Basket employee Jonathan Pica are taking to the streets.
I'm out here doing what I believe is right, what I stand up for a man who would do the same for us.
That man is Arthur T. Demoulas, the former CEO of the Market Basket grocery chain. Now, that middle initial T is important because there is another Arthur Demoulas, and Arthur S. Demoulas. He's RDT's first cousin. And as family will sometimes do when great amounts of money are involved, these two Arthurs have been fighting over Market Basket for decades. That fighting over the company their grandfather founded came to a climax this summer when Arthur S. managed to oust Arthur T. as CEO by consolidating family support. Workers balked. They picketed and urged a boycott. And at the end of the first week, they rallied.
The media says that they've never seen anything like this before. And I heard a professor on the radio the other day, and he said, this is unprecedented and historic. Well, I got news. Welcome to Market Basket!
Yeah! That's RDT's nephew, Mike Kettenbach. He's standing on a black truck parked in a strip mall in front of a Kmart and addressing thousands of people wearing shirts with the words RDT or simply ATD. And these protests have had a huge effect on Market Basket's business. Just as regular people and employees taking to the streets to protest a CEO's firing might seem like a precursor to the apocalypse, the stores look like the end times have already happened. The shelves are bare, and everyone seems to be gone from Market Baskets. Meanwhile, supporters of RDT have even written songs like this one that was put on YouTube.
A tisky, a tasky, dear Market Basket, firing you.
And that brings us to this bigger question. Why RDT? What is it about the guy that has made people so angry he's been forced out of Market Basket? Well, the people here at these rallies tell stories about him calling them personally when their children were in the hospital, or giving out unexpected college scholarships, or just coming through stores regularly and shaking people's hands, making them feel respected. And more than that, they say RDT was generous. Picketer Carol Medina says she and her husband raised a family of four solely on his assistant manager's salary.
When so many families depend on everything that RDT has done for them years and years, and now they just want to, you know, they want to trim it and just make these changes, and it's just unfair. It's just unfair.
It's hard to find people who disagree. And besides the dismissal of RDT, the public isn't really complaining about anything the company's done. But it's not as if the CEOs are making a case for the company. They've declined repeated requests for comment. Lately, the two new CEOs have been issuing general email statements. First, they asked employees and customers to give them time to earn their trust. Then they asked workers to return to their jobs and promised there'd be no penalty. And then the new CEOs set a deadline for workers to return or lose their jobs, this coming Monday. Former warehouse supervisor Dean Joyce was fired after protesting, and he says the company won't be able to recover without him and his workers.
They brought in a few, we'll call them substitute workers, but those guys couldn't shine the shoes of my guys. They couldn't shine the shoes, and maybe they have six guys in there trying to fill in for me. Good luck to them. They are in way over their heads. They have no idea what they're doing. Only, I have three things to say. ATD, number one.
As for Arthur T. Demoulas, he's issued just one statement saying eight fired employees should be reinstated. But very quietly, he's been gathering support from investors to make his own bid to outright buy the company from the rest of his family. He says his offer is fair. The Market Basket Board of Directors has been considering it for a week while losing millions of dollars in business and watching as their customers and employees fight for a man in the 1%. In Boston, I'm Rupa Shenoy for Marketplace.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Now a story about what we spend and owe on a global scale. The word sanctions gets tossed around a lot. It's an international punishment, the go-to way to isolate and starve a bad actor using money. This week, the U.S. and the EU tightened the screws on Russia with even more sanctions. So how do these things work anyway? To find out, we met up with an economist outside the United Nations.
I am Cheryl King. I am the Senior Director of Research for Rubini Global Economics.
We're standing outside the UN because we are thinking and talking about international pressure, international economic pressure. And I think the first question a lot of Americans have is, do sanctions actually work? Do they do anything?
There do seem to be a lot of them going around right now.
Yeah.
You know, rather interestingly, the methodology that the U.S. and the European Union have been deploying more recently probably have a better chance of having an impact now than they have in the future, because they're not just saying, we're not going to trade in certain goods. We're going to hit you more where it really hurts.
The test case when we are thinking probably about Russia, I guess, is Iran here. That is sort of the thing that the international community has looked at in the past few years. And the Obama administration would make the argument, hey, these economic sanctions maybe brought Iran to the negotiating table. Can we measure the effect that sanctions on Iran had?
Well, as an economist, I would say that it would be easier to do it if they were just doing it through trade flows, because it's a lot easier to measure in that respect. And in that respect, they're pretty minimal in terms of the impact on the U.S. economy.
But for Iran, they're big.
And, you know, the idea is that it's going to hurt them more than it's going to hurt us.
When you look at Russia, we're talking about a great big economy and one where they have a lot of oil and gas. They trade certainly with a lot of European countries, sell oil and gas to them. That's the one place where we're not seeing great big sanctions. So is it possible to know if these sanctions are going to make a dent and if Vladimir Putin or your regular Russian family is going to feel it?
Mm-hmm. That's the big unknown right now. Right now, the way that we're thinking about it is Russia doesn't have a lot of clients, and the EU doesn't have a lot of other sources of gas. So going to that step would be the equivalent of nuclear assured destruction. It would be a very big negative for both of them. And that's why we think that it's not going to go that far.
That they wouldn't say, all right, fine, your oil and gas, we're cutting them off.
That's right. And even if they do shut off the gas, from the analysis that we've done, it suggests that if it's brief, it is not going to have a material impact on EU GDP numbers.
So when you think about sanctions, then, what kind of a tool are they? Are they blunt? Are they precise? Are they a useful weapon?
Well, I think that they're all relatively blunt. But, you know, I think that you have to think about it in the manner of turning up the screws. And that's basically what the administrations within D.C. and what's going on within the EU as well. I mean, and other countries as well, obviously, that as they continue to resist what the will is in terms of their behavior towards the Ukraine, in terms of what the rest of the world feels that it should happen, that there is an agenda of increasingly more punitive steps that they can take.
There are a lot of big international companies and American companies that do business in Russia or with Russian partners. So, for example, ExxonMobil drills with Rosneft, or you have Ford that does deals there as well. Do you think we'll start to see kind of follow-on effects on those companies from these sanctions?
Yeah, it's definitely possible that it would spill over into other areas because Russia is perfectly willing to go tit for tat as well. We're definitely seeing that they've turned up the rhetoric on them, and I think that will be difficult. And we're already thinking that what's been imposed already could take a couple of tenths off of Eurozone GDP. And considering that the economy's not doing very well to begin with right now, it's activity that they really can't afford to lose right now.
Yeah, things are not so hot in Europe. They weathered a crisis, but they're still very high.
Well, weathering a crisis.
Weathering a crisis. There's still very high unemployment in Europe. Yep. You have a lot of young people who aren't working. Mm-hmm. This, I think, is probably a little tougher for the EU to stomach than it is for us, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Even within the euro area, which includes the UK, you could see that the areas that were arguing for a certain type of sanction were the ones that were less exposed to that type of activity. So, for example, the UK wanted to see more trade sanctions and the Eurozone wanted to see more financial sanctions because the UK obviously has more financial ties with Russia than the rest of the Eurozone does.
Cheryl King from Rubini Global Economics, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And that brings us to the weekend number. Our number is 100. That's the percentage of debt the Bank of Moscow holds in dollars, according to senior U.S. officials. What does that mean? Well, according to those same officials, it means that the bank and others like it will have a tough, if not impossible, time getting mid-range or long-term debt financing. We're willing to bet you spend a ton on childcare. It can hit your wallet hard, but we're here to soften the blow.
This is something where you really don't want to cut costs, but there are some creative ways that you can get around shelling out quite so much.
Lauren Lyons-Cole has some great advice. That's next on Marketplace Weekend from APM. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Our next story is about one of the most important things we spend our money on, childcare. And it was inspired by one of our listeners.
Hey, Marketplace Weekend. My name is Emily, and I'm from Minneapolis. Childcare is a huge deal, both financially and emotionally, for my husband and me. We have two boys, 5 and 1. We both have full-time public sector jobs. And making the best decision on childcare is never cheap, and it's never over.
To dig a little bit more into the economics of childcare, we invited Danielle Kurtzleben from Vox to help explain. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about the cost of childcare in America.
The cost of childcare in America has risen far faster than the cost of everything else in America. If you look at the Consumer Price Index, as I did in one of my articles, I looked at it over the last 20 years. The Consumer Price Index went up roughly half as fast as the cost of childcare. So childcare is really outstripping a lot of other things. I should add this lumps in two things, childcare and nursery school. But what this lumps together is basically the cost of taking care of a kid before that kid gets into the school system, is old enough for that school system.
Do we know what's behind that rising cost?
There are a lot of theories out there, of course, and there are plenty of things that play into it. One theory that I've heard quite a bit, especially here in the Washington, D.C. metro area, is the question of regulations. Of course, you want well-qualified people watching your children in a very safe environment, and you don't want, 50 kids to one child caregiver. So, of course, there are plenty of regulations are great, but I have heard parents complain about excessive regulations, about a building having to be completed for so long before kids can start, the number of people required per child. Things like this can play into it and can raise the price. And depending on the standards in any given local area, that can push the cost up. But that is just one thing. There are all sorts of other things. Another thing is just that everybody needs it. And clearly there are plenty of parents who are willing to pay high prices just to get their kids taken care of while they go for work.
There seems to be kind of macroeconomic effects that come just from the amount of money we spend on caring for kids before they get to school.
Exactly. And this is something that I've been really interested in. In some states, the median cost of out-of-pocket childcare expenses as a ratio to the median earnings of a single mom can exceed one-fifth or even get up to one-fourth of those paychecks that those single mothers are earning. That is huge. In some places, that's like paying a second rent. That's gargantuan. And it creates this tough choice for those moms, and it creates a tough choice for mothers in partnered or married relationships as well. It's not always, but often women end up bearing the brunt of childcare, taking on a lot of it themselves. And more often than not, women will be the ones who stay home to take care of a child. And so, yes, there is the potential that this is keeping women out of the labor force. This is bringing down their labor force participation. And one case study that you can look at against the U.S. is France, where there are more state supports for childcare. The gap between men and women in labor force participation in France is much smaller than it is in the U.S. right now. And one idea that has been floated is that it's because France gives parents a little bit more help than we do here in the U.S.
How do we stack up against other developed countries?
According to recent figures from the OECD, American parents ended up paying, in terms of their net cost, the percentage of their net family income. Childcare-related costs, this is, so there are a few things folded in here, ended up being something to the effect of 40% of net family income. Now, that's huge. Countries like Switzerland, Ireland, and UK are the only ones ahead of us, but you have dozens behind us. In plenty of other countries, the net cost is much lower. And part of that is government offsets, childcare benefits from governments. The Netherlands does this pretty generously, as does Belgium. And there are also some tax reductions in some countries as well.
So maybe some of those states have more generous support programs. Some of those also have higher tax burdens as well. I would imagine that those tax revenues go to support some of those programs.
Absolutely. And you're right. There are two sides to this coin. If your state is helping you out a lot on your child care, I mean, that money has to come from somewhere, and it is probably coming from taxpayer pockets.
Danielle Kurtzleben is a correspondent for Vox. Thanks so much for talking with us.
No problem. Thank you.
Over the past week, we've been asking our followers online how they pay for child care, how they make it work. And we got a lot of responses about your experiences. Here's what one of our listeners had to say.
This is Chris calling from Milwaukee, and I will say that after 6.5 years of making monthly payments for daycare and preschool, both of our children will be entering public school this fall. Making payments each month was a huge expense, and for a while we were paying more than $1,000 a month for two children. We survived by altering our spending in other ways, like reducing our retirement contributions, buying a used car, and holding off on major purchases like furniture and house remodeling. We also took advantage of employer-sponsored plans for payroll deduction reimbursement of the cost.
To talk a little bit more about the cost of childcare and how to manage all of this, we're joined by Lauren Lyons-Cole. She's a personal finance writer for The Street, and she's with me now. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend, Lauren.
Thanks for having me, Lizzie.
So that was Chris you heard from. $1,000 a month for two kids, that sounds like a lot. We looked at national averages, though, and that's about right on par with what most people pay. Do you have any tips on how to hold down the cost of childcare?
When it comes to childcare, the problem is, I don't know that it's a problem, but people don't want to cut back. That's not an area, you know, you might be
right,
willing.
This is your kid.
It's your kid. It's not your dinner, you know. So this is something where you really don't want to cut costs. But there are some creative ways that you can get around shelling out quite so much. One of my favorite things that I've heard of are people actually paying for their parents to relocate to their city.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So if you're tied to a location, let's say New York, San Francisco, somewhere where your job opportunities are, and if you like your parents and they live somewhere else, you might be able to afford to pay an apartment or maybe get a bigger apartment, have them live with you. And that way they can watch your kids. It's a little bit better way to direct money towards childcare, and it might end up cheaper in the long run.
What are the other creative ways that are out there to think about how you do this?
if you know other people in your area, if you can connect with other parents who are in the same boat, there is a new idea around this sort of developing a childcare co-op. So if you're working Monday, Wednesday, if your neighbor's working Tuesday, Thursday, I mean, this is, you know, all the stars have to align, but that's another creative idea.
There are some tax breaks that are out there for taking care of your children. I think some people don't know about them. Walk us through those.
Okay, so if your employer offers a flex spending account that you can use towards dependent care, it may seem like a hassle, and sometimes there's a lot of paperwork involved, but you can put away up to $5,000 pre-tax money. Now, if you're paying 25% of your income towards taxes, that means for all that hassle, all the paperwork you have to file, you're earning $1,250 in tax benefits. And that's real money. So it's something to consider. Even though you may not enjoy every bit of the process, calculate your hourly rate and it might be higher than your job. So definitely take advantage of those if you have it available to you.
I want to turn now away a little bit from some of the financials to one of the kind of larger questions behind raising kids and the idea of kind of how you balance this stuff out. How do you make that call that it makes more sense financially or for your family for one of you to stay home?
You know, I think this is a really emotionally charged decision. There is no one right answer. There's no one easy answer. But leaving the workforce has, it's not a one-to-one comparison. It's not like I earn X amount, childcare is this amount. Because when you leave the workforce, you're also, you know, losing long-term earning potential. You know, and the other thing is, you're a parent, but you're also a person. And so you need that sense of accomplishment. And maybe that's raising children, and that's great. And if it's also going to your job every day and contributing to society in another way, that's great too. And that also shows your children a different perspective. And if you are paid enough where you can not only afford childcare, but also to fund a 529 plan for them, it's a win-win all around. So there's a lot of different things to consider. It's really not a straightforward conversation.
Lauren Lyons-Cole, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Lizzie. It's always a pleasure.
For next week's show, we want to help you with your debts. We learned this week that one in three Americans is not paying their bills on time. So tell us about the debt that keeps you up at night, and we'll help you make a plan. Our website is marketplaceweekend.org, and we're on Twitter, at MarketplaceWKND. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. There's a phrase in economics when something has hit its high and saturated the market. It's peaked.
Open Gangnam Style.
The Harlem Shake is taking over YouTube.
That Hansel's so hot right now.
It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot.
I am so damn over this.
Over it, huh? Well, we're starting a new economic indicator on our show and declaring when things have peaked. And this week, yeah, we're saying it. We have reached peak kale. Writer Jane Black explains.
If you were a foodie at the dawn of the 20th century, though no one would have called you a foodie back then, you probably would have paid attention to what Horace Fletcher had to say. Fletcher was neither a scientist nor a chef. He was a wealthy businessman. Still, he pioneered a technique called Fletcherizing, or chewing each bite 32 times, and it was soon accepted as a key to good health. Nature will castigate those who don't masticate, he warned. The concept seems ridiculous today, but each food fad is a reflection of its own time. Today, we have kale. Glamorous but respectable, sexy but not in a cookie-cutter way, the Cate Blanchett of vegetables. And like any starlet that has hit the big time, kale is everywhere. It bumps romaine out of Caesar salads, and it curls across pizza and alongside locally raised pork chops. It's even the muse for a part cookbook, part love letter. Wait for it, 50 Shades of Kale. But why kale, and why now? To its credit, kale has a vibrant history. It emerged in ancient Egypt, Greece, and Rome. And by the Middle Ages, it became so popular in England and Scotland that kale became another word for dinner. During World War II, Britain urged home gardeners to grow kale for its Dig for Victory campaign. Today, kale offers those who cook it a kind of badge of honor. Rightly or wrongly, it signals a cook's commitment to farm-to-table values like buying local and, of course, eating your vegetables. Yet with every fad comes the inevitable backlash. The first haters are attacking not kale's pretensions of grandeur, but its health credentials. Apparently, all those raw kale salads are a waste. To get the nutrients, you need to cook the stuff. Unlike France, Italy, and China, the U.S. goes through food fads faster than a box of $4 cupcakes at an office party. So those critiques matter. For proof, you need only think about all those other it vegetables. Remember sun-dried tomatoes, arugula? How about portobello mushrooms? Still, this backlash has yet to change people's minds. There's a petition on change.org to make the first Wednesday of October National Kale Day. And the folk artist, Beau Muller Moore, is locked in a trademark battle with Chick-fil-A to allow him to keep selling T-shirts that read, "Eat More Kale." If the ubiquitous raw kale salad can't live up to its nutritious and culinary promise, perhaps the solution is to mix and match culinary fads. Put that arugula, mushrooms, and sun-dried tomatoes back in your bowls. Anybody ready to Fletcherize?
Jane Black is a food writer based in New York. Check out our Peak Indicator on MarketplaceWeekend.org. As we were researching kale, we learned this upcoming week has been declared National Farmers Market Week by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Farmers markets have been a big success in urban areas, and maybe you do some of your weekend spending there. 20 years ago, there were just under 2,000 farmers markets in the U.S. Now there are more than 8,000. But what about the farmers? How are they doing? Here's one farmer's story.
My name is Chuck Eggert, and I'm the founder and president of Pacific Foods of Oregon in Tualatin, Oregon.
They specialize in organic foods, and we asked Chuck to share what he's learned from farming. That starts at the bottom with good soil.
Well, I think when you look at conventional soils, what typically has happened is there's very little organic matter. So if you went to pick it up, it's almost like a dirt clod. And when we then contrast it with organic soils, then you can pick that up, and just break the soil by your hand. And it isn't clayey. And it just smells fresh. It smells like fresh soil should. And animals can tell whether grass has been contaminated. You can tell, the health of something by who's eating it.
Chuck and his family started the business back before the word organic was everywhere and farmers markets popped up all over. Chuck quit his job as a CFO to start a farm. We asked him how his wife took that news.
Luana, my wife now of 43 years, I don't think this would have been possible without Luana's participation, because if you're in a relationship where one person disagrees with what the other one is doing, it typically fails. And I think she, as well as I, take a great deal of pride in the fact that when people come up, last year we had some corn silage that was, 16 feet tall, and everyone thought it was conventional corn. And we said, no, it's organic corn. And we actually would take people out and take pictures in the corn of them being dwarfed by this organic corn. And I think sharing that message to people that you can do these things, and you can, sometimes it takes a little more work. But normally I use her for the prop and the picture because she's better looking than I am.
Pacific Foods is one of the most successful operations in the Northwest. Chuck says that's because the company constantly reinvests in the farm.
Money's never been a particularly motivating factor. And Luann and I were talking, and I said, it's interesting. If I wasn't doing what I was doing and I could pick another profession, I'd be doing what I'm doing. And I've never understood the whole concept of entrepreneurship, that it's about making money. Well, it is. It really isn't. It's about being constructive and doing it different. And to me, the mark of a true entrepreneur is that they'd take the last nickel they had and try something new with it. I joke that I've saved the money for 19 Porsches, but I've never owned one. And it's because it always gets spent on something else. Anytime we accumulate something, we buy some farmland or buy some equipment. And her only rule is that when she dies, I have to put a plaque on the stainless steel tank I'll buy with her insurance money.
That's Chuck Eggert. He's the founder of Pacific Foods of Oregon. They got into the organic business more than 25 years ago. And that's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Next time, we'll have some brunch and talk about something a lot of us take for granted and maybe shouldn't, and that's water. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and John Sepulvedo. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll see you next weekend. This is APM.